Hello and welcome to Nufiken. I am Irina and today I am talking to Linda Ahl, who did her PhD thesis on mathematics education for adults, using as a starting point her own practice as a teacher in the Swedish prison system.
Hello, Irina.
Hello, Linda. You have done your thesis in the Department of Pedagogics at Stockholm University.
Yeah, Department for Maths and Science Education.
And your topic is teaching mathematics in Swedish prisons.
Yes, more precise, it's about individualized instruction for adults, and it's in a prison education context.
You have yourself taught for 13 years, if I'm correct?
Yes, I have taught since 2007. For quite a long time, I was teaching full-time and was doing my PhD studies on my own time, and the last year I have taught for 50%.
Oh, so you did a lot of your research on your own time.
Yes, we have quite a lot of time for reflection and preparing and so on, so I could do a lot on my work time. My research actually is my work, to reflect on students' results.
What was the aim of your thesis?
To improve practice so that more of my students get better opportunities to fulfill their courses.
You are trying to have the results of your research used to improve practice of other teachers as well.
I mean, all research has to be adapted into the practice, but I think that my results can be used all teachers that teach adults.
Is it common for researchers in pedagogics to also be teachers at the same time?
I don't know how common it is, but the interest is growing in the recent years. We have a journal with the greatest impact. In 2017, all their editorials were talking about how to implement research results into practice. Because we have been doing this research on maths education for at least 50 years, but the results, they stay in the research community, they don't reach practice. It's one way to get the results into practice, to do practice-close research.
Are there any ethical considerations when you interact with students, both as their teacher and as someone researching?
Quite a lot, actually, because we have the question of our relations. I have a quite close relation to my students. I don't have so many students, and we have a lot of interaction, and that could be a problem if you should interview students, because I think that the answers will be biased. For that reason, I have worked with a colleague when I have been doing interviews whom they didn't know before. And then we have the question about the data. You have to volunteer to participate in research. If I conduct teaching and I have student solutions, they are just working material when I am a teacher. And after the students have finished the course, they got a grade, then if I ask them, can I use this solution, you will be anonymous. I will use it for research, and they agree. It's just them that it turns into data for research. They are already graded, so they don't have some power relation to attend to. So mainly the data part that's problematic, and that you don't put your students in situations where they feel that they are in a power relation that would be negative for them.
Your research is placed both in adult education and in mathematics pedagogics, at the intersection of these two topics. Can you tell me a bit about this field? What makes it so different from other types of studies in education?
Yes, and I can tell you why it's not very different also. But the thing that are different is that adult education embrace informal education, like you learn things on your workplace, to run a machine or to do something. And non-formal education that you learn maybe in your everyday life, what's the best way to calculate if you have enough money in the shop. And also formal education, when others go back to school. The formal bit, the one I have investigated, it doesn't differ much from ordinary maths education. I found out that adults and adolescents, they have the same conceptual difficulties. If you haven't been taught how to handle a scientific concept, you have no benefits from being an adult. When you teach adults, they usually have been away from schooling for some years. Some have been away for 2 years and some for 20 years. So that's special for adults, that you don't know what prior knowledge they come to class with. that's kind of a challenge for the teacher to organize instruction for everyone, that works for everyone. You cannot do that in the same way that you can do with children and adolescents, because they, you know that they have been in the prior grade the year before. It's a part of motivation. If you have to go back and read mathematics as an adult, it means that you didn't succeed the last time. Adults, they have more negative feelings about mathematics as a subject than children and adolescents, because they often have a failure with them when they come to class.
What makes mathematics as a subject special, or is it?
Mathematics education is very broad. You can study how you learn a mathematics concept, and you can study the atmosphere in the classroom, and everything belongs to mathematics education. Actually, we have a lot of maths education studies without any maths in it. But what you can say is that mathematics is like a high-stakes subject. If you should compare to language, I think that the most important subject in school is Swedish language, and after that it is English. But mathematics is special because a lot of people have difficulties with learning mathematics, and at the same time they have to do it, because if they don't have a passing grade in mathematics, they cannot be anything. So it's a gatekeeper in our educational system. That makes mathematics especially interesting. As long as the policy documents will focus on everyone has to learn mathematics, it is important that we research mathematics education to see how we can give students opportunities to succeed.
So mathematics is a gatekeeper to all higher education?
Even a vocational education. If you want to be like a plumber, you have to have mathematics. If you have problems with mathematics, you have problems with getting into society.
What were the research questions you were interested in?
Two of my four questions is about prior knowledge and motivation in combination with the high level of negative affective feelings that others have to mathematics. One question is a really retrospective reflection of events. Something happened that made me investigate what was the cause of the events. It was one person that was very hard to deliver feedback to. And I found out that if you deliver feedback in a written form, give the students time to reflect on their feedback before we discuss it, then it works much better for him. And then I found out that it works much better with everyone, actually. So that question was just, it was coming to me.
From your practice as a teacher?
Yeah, it wasn't planned in the way. I mean, this with the prior knowledge and the motivation, you see it all the time. But this one, I hadn't been thinking about it so much until this special, we call it an outlier case, that brings your attention to something. And the third question is a springer from my first question, the one about prior knowledge.
Should we touch a bit on the prison background? This is just the setting of the formal education that you're analyzing. The instruction in prisons, as you say in your thesis, is individualized. What does that mean, and how is this different from other settings?
Actually, all education in Sweden should be individualized by law. But of course, if you have a whole class with 30 students, a bit harder than it is for me, because I have 15 students in distance education, and then I have maybe 3 to 5 students in my classroom. And they have different courses, of course, but I have a lot of time to attend to their different needs. Tailor the content and the instructional technology and pace to the abilities and interests of each student. Then I must say that instructional technology is a bit poor in the prison because they don't have internet, but we can put films in an intranet.
So you have to be adaptable from this point of view. You also mentioned that the education can switch from being in person to being on distance.
Yes, because people in Sweden, they are moved between prisons, because you have high security prisons and you have low security prisons. And if you start your sentence in a high security prison, the intention is that you will be moved down in the systems and end your sentence in a low security prison. Our organization builds on that. If I take on a student, he's assigned to me, he will follow me, even when he switches prison.
So you're not employed by a particular prison?
I'm employed by the Swedish Prison and Probation Service. It's called Kriminalvården. It has all the prisons in Sweden. But I have one prison where I have my office and I have students. Then I also have students in distance education.
You may start at any time rather than having semesters.
Yeah, no semesters. They can be enrolled at any time point during the year. And they also have different, some people study all week and some people study 2 days a week and some people study just in the afternoons.
Let's start with the assessment of prior knowledge in students. So for this, you designed a test.
Before I did this PhD, I have done licentiate thesis about curriculum materials. And then I chose to investigate how curriculum materials presented proportional reasoning. So I used that when I was designing this test.
What is proportional reasoning?
Proportional reasoning is, it's about multiplying, actually, comparing fractions. Also, if you think of a line of function, that's also the definition of proportion. If you say that the proportion is an equality of two ratios or represented as a function, then proportional reasoning is the action that students do when they are handling situations where you have to multiply and add. Usually, you know two quantities and you want to know third, so-called missing value problem. Also, comparing fraction is proportional reasoning. You also need proportional reasoning to scale up and down. And actually, in first course in upper secondary school, at least 70% of the course content relies on proportional reasoning. So it's pretty much the core of the mathematics we teach in school.
So you're saying that you used your knowledge of how central proportional reasoning is to curricula?
The same idea appears over and over again in the different topics, but you actually don't teach proportional reasoning in Swedish schools. But if you can crack the code, then you will be very successful on the national tests and so on. So it says quite a lot about what you have learned or what you remember from your earlier studies. So that is why it's a good subject. Instead of testing a lot of different skills, I test the reasoning skills in different topics.
You designed a test for this, and the test is to work in conjunction with an interview.
Yes, and I think the interview is really pivotal. If you don't do the interview, you don't get enough information. It's easy to take the test. You just mark if a statement is true or false, and then you choose one argument out of four to support a claim. And then in the interview, you ask the students, so why did you choose this and how do you think? And then in the interview, I also ask about their mathematical story and about their rationale for taking up mathematics again. So then I can do like initial profile on their prior knowledge and their motivation. And then I can design their first assignment so as they are not too challenging or not too easy.
What motivated you in creating new tests?
The test items have been used in research. So, you know, for every question, you know a lot about maybe why the students picked the wrong argument. What can be the reason for that? So it's easy for the students to take, but it gives me a lot of information if the interview will also indicate that this misunderstanding or lack of knowledge that is behind.
So there exists research that takes you from these questions to the reasoning or helps you see the reasoning behind them together with the interview.
Yes, already conducted research about how students reason. And I know everything about what may be the reason for students to pick the wrong argument. And when they are explaining to me why they choose this argument, I can have my analyze confirmed or not. So I can gain quite a lot of knowledge about students' prior knowledge. There are extensive research on proportional reasoning because it's so important in mathematics. And a lot of tests has been done on students. And I use items from the middle grades, from grades 7 to 9, and from upper secondary school the first year. And actually, it's necessary to follow the course that they are assigned to.
So you are using this test now successfully in your teaching?
Yes, I do.
Can it be generalized and adopted in more settings?
Yes, I think it could. But maybe you want to use the test. if you are yourself interested in proportional reasoning as a teacher. Otherwise, you might think it's difficult yourself, you know? But I think that everyone could use it. It is not the case that everyone will want to use it, but the idea that maybe if I have a test that is not too much time but gives a lot of information, it would be easier for me to design instruction. That idea, I think, could work for any teacher.
How many students have you used the test and interview on?
I have used it now on 130 at least. But when I wrote the article, it was only like 25 or 30 students. But I could see that it spread very well. And that was my aim, to see that not everyone makes the same errors, except for this one task, so that I could see that it discriminates well among students and it be conducted in a limited time without leaving the students with a bad feeling.
Speaking of bad feelings, for the second test you looked at motivation, started from the existing theories and checked to see whether they apply to a case study.
Well, actually, I'm not an expert on motivational theories. I have read up on them when I was searching for a theoretical frame to do this study. Then I have decided that they wasn't for me. So I'm much better on the theory I use. But in short, the main reason for not using the more well-known existing motivational theories is that they ask the questions, how can you get students to be more motivated to accept the teaching that we offer them? And my question is not that, it's the other way around. How can I as a teacher adjust to the student? So I read up on the motivational theories, I decided not to use them, and then I kind of forgotten them. I don't say that they are not good, but they are not good for my purpose. And that's another important message, I think, that the theories, they should work for you, and it's the kind of research that you want to do that have to decide what theoretical constructs you use. It's not to dismiss other motivational theories that I haven't chosen them. It's because this one fits me better for this purpose.
The theory that you did choose, what are its claim and its framework?
It's about different rationales for learning. It's the I-rational, and that's about getting a grade to be able to get a good education and a job in society. The reproduction of labor. And the S-rational is I can do maths because everyone I know is good at maths. I like maths. It's something that I can identify with. And that is quite different. I found that many people have this irrational. They have a student career counselor that has told them that they have to do the maths. Otherwise, they cannot fulfill their dreams. And they are very motivated to get a grade, but they don't like maths. And these students have quite fragile motivation. We cannot give them too hard challenges because then they will lose faith and they will drop out. And the other ones, the ones that like mathematics, they are not so fragile. You can challenge them much more. And that's important, especially in the beginning. I have experienced this through my teaching practice. But I didn't know beforehand, because when I talked to students when they come and they said, I'm so motivated. Then before this, I couldn't make a difference because I didn't know if it was this S or I-rational that drove the students. Then I couldn't individualize instruction.
So it's not the intensity of the motivation that you are trying to adjust to, but the type.
Yes, according to this theory, the perfect situation is when I and S-rational coincide. But it also says that if the irrational breaks down, you have to reach the motivation through the S-rational. You have to build up the S-rational.
And how has your case study supported this?
We interviewed quite a lot of students, but then we chose to display this one case because it was very telling for the rationals. It's interesting because he could really explain how he felt. In the first interview, he said that he had groups in his social environment that all liked mathematics, they were good at mathematics, and they also expected him to be good at mathematics. But he wasn't. It was hard for him from the beginning. He had a feeling that mathematics wasn't for him. He said that mathematics was like trying to look right and left at the same time. He dropped out upper secondary school. And now, when he was serving a prison sentence, and he had talked to a studying careers counselor, and he said that, well, you really need maths if you want to get on in the educational system. He was interested in reading and words, so I gave him a lot of books to read about mathematics and popular science books. And we discussed that, and we talked a lot about the history of mathematics, and we worked in groups with problems, and he really enjoyed that. So he started to enjoy mathematics very, very much, and he was interviewed in three occasions. And already in the second occasion, the S-rationale had grown very strong, so it was easy to see that. In the end, he was just, oh, I love mathematics. I don't care if I get a grade.
So you adapted your practice to activate this other motivation?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can do that if you know what kind of motivation it is.
Let's talk a bit about the third study as well.
It's just amazing that I haven't thought about this earlier. When I give students formative feedback, I don't give them points. If I have the students in my prism, I call for the student and I say, yeah, we should look at this assignment. And you see here, you've done this. And the person in this study, he left the room, slamming the door, and yeah.
So reacted negatively to feedback.
He just couldn't take critique. I said to my colleague, this will never work. I can't teach him because he won't listen. But then he was transferred to another prison, and because I have special afternoons and so on for giving feedback and special days for phoning students. So there often are a delay between when I submit the written feedback in an internet forum and when I phone them. And then I phoned him, and he was just like, this was very interesting, you know, and I've been looking up in books, and now I know that. Actually, I found out this as well. It was in, and I was just, what has happened? Of course, when you get we get back to our feedbacks. When you get the negative feedback on your writing, if you just close your computer and look at it after one day or two, then you just, yeah, that's good critique. It will really improve my work. Do you recognize that?
Yes, that's a very relatable feeling, of course. Yes.
I couldn't understand until this event that, of course, it's the same for our students in feedback situations. Now I do that with all my students.
So this is another finding that you think can be generalized?
Yes, it's really easy to generalize to all contexts, I think.
So as opposed to the study about motivation, here it feels that there was no theory about feedback that you were using.
No, this study wasn't planned, you know, it's a retrospective reflection. And of course, I read up upon timing on feedback afterwards. There are different meanings about how to deliver feedback. There are researchers that think that feedback should be delivered immediately, because otherwise it may consolidate your errors. And there are researchers that think that feedback should be delayed.
But these are about the delay between you receiving the solutions and you giving the feedback. What about delay between you giving the feedback and you discussing the feedback?
Well, I haven't found so much research on that, actually.
Do you see any theory growing from your reflection in the future?
I choose to call it a practical framework in my thesis. So you have some case that illustrates that there are existence proofs that this case can be. And there is some kind of cure. It's not so complicated that you have to have theoretical elaboration around it. You can just use it as a practical tool.
So to end it, I would like to ask you something about the future. So first of all, about your research, how do you see it being used in the future? We talked about how these results could be generalized, but do you have a more concrete feeling?
Yes, of course, it's not up to me, but if people that are doing adult education are interested, of course they can use a lot. The thing I can do is to talk about my research and make other adult educators aware that this exists.
Are you planning to continue in research?
Yes, I'm planning to continue. I'm interested in implementing research results in educational context.
Thank you for joining.
Thank you, Irina, and good luck. Bye!
You have listened to Newfiken. This was Irina talking to Linda Ohl, who has finished her PhD at the Department of Math and Science Education at the University of Stockholm. If you want to know more about Linda's research, you can find more information at our webpage, newfiken.co. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook as Curious Newfiken in one word. This episode of Newfiken was published in September 2020.